In the last hour, we saw something of the biblical principles of government. We saw how those principles were written into the Constitution of the United States with that fivefold formula for freedom. Without looking back at the notes, can we go through that fivefold formula? One, what is it? Limited delegated powers. Two, and I have this reversed, separation of powers. Three, checks and balances. Four, reserved individual rights. And five, responsibility through religion. Today we're going to talk about the war on the Constitution and how these principles of constitutional law are being subverted today. And let's begin by mentioning that the framers had a belief about law, that law was rooted in truth itself, and that since truth is God-ordained and unchanging, law would be God-ordained and unchanging as well. After all, we read in the book of Hebrews, Jesus Christ, the same yesterday, today, forever. And when Jesus says, I am the truth, if Jesus is the truth, and if truth doesn't change, and if Jesus doesn't change, then truth doesn't change, and therefore principles of law don't change. That was one of the common understandings of the old common law. Common law that originates with the Angles and Saxons in northern Germany, defended by Hermann the Liberator in 9 AD in the Battle of Teutoburg Forest, where he resisted the Roman legions and preserved northern Germany and Scandinavia from Roman law and enabled them to continue with their Saxon traditions of law. That's the same common law that the Angles and Saxons and Jutes then brought to the British Isles in the 400s and renamed them Angleland or England. It becomes the common law of England, which becomes the common law of the United States. And it was said of that law that this law had its roots in God himself and it does not change over the ages. And Blackstone makes that very clear in his commentaries, that law doesn't change over the years, and a judge does not make law when he announces a decision. Rather, a judge discovers the law and applies it. That was the view of law that the framers had. It was based, first of all, upon a biblical view of truth itself, but it's also based upon a Newtonian worldview, the worldview of Sir Isaac Newton, who some have suggested might have been a deist, but if you read through his writings, he clearly affirms the truth of Scripture. In fact, he was especially fascinated by biblical prophecy and wrote extensively about Old Testament biblical prophecy. Some of his interpretations I'd probably consider a little esoteric, but nevertheless, that he took the Scripture seriously and considered himself a Christian is very clear. But the Newtonian worldview is of a world that is unchanging. That it is a world based on laws. The laws of mathematics don't change. The laws of physics don't change. We had lived in North Dakota and South Dakota and attended seminary in northern Minnesota and from there to Oklahoma and to Alabama. And when our friends up in the upper Midwest will ask us, well, what are your winters like in Alabama? And I'll tell them, well, it might get down to 10 degrees sometimes, and it can get pretty cold sometimes there, especially in northern Alabama. But it doesn't snow down there, does it? I just say, well, according to the laws of physics, water freezes at 32 degrees Fahrenheit in Alabama just like it does in Minnesota. And that is the principle of Newtonian law, the principle that water freezes at 32 degrees Fahrenheit, and 2 plus 2 equals 4, and H2O gives you oxygen, whether you're doing that here, or whether you're doing it on the dark side of the moon, or in the next galaxy, and whether you did it today, or 6,000 years ago, or thousands of years from now. unchanging natural laws, and likewise, unchanging moral laws. And the common law itself is based upon that view. Not only that, but other than through the saving grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, human nature doesn't change. John Adams once said that human nature hasn't changed since the Garden of Eden and is not likely to change till the millennium. And anyway, so that being the case, when we talk about the need to update and modernize the Constitution, what we need to remember is that the Constitution is based upon basic laws of God and a basic view of human nature. And neither of those change. Now, there may be certain applications that might have to change from time to time, but the underlying principles do not. Now, we compare that to today, and we see the way judges are deciding cases around the Constitution rather than under the Constitution. And what we have to say about this is that it really comes down to a changing view, not just of constitutional law, but a changing view of truth itself. And I could go through a course in Philosophy 101 to show a little of how we get that way. We could start out with George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel there with his dialectic that says truth changes with time. You start out with one idea that we call a thesis. Maybe capitalism is your thesis. And then up comes an alternate idea, the opposite idea is antithesis. Conflict between those takes place and a synthesis comes out of them, maybe democratic socialism or something like that. And then that becomes the new thesis, the new antithesis arises and so on. And so truth changes with time. Tie that in then with Darwin and with Darwin's view that we see a world in flux, a world that is changing, and a guiding principle that makes that change. And of course, the concept of evolution did not originate with Darwin. It had been around for actually thousands of years before that. But Darwin added a new guiding principle for the theory of evolution, that being natural selection. With natural selection, of course, the idea that there is a constant struggle for survival because you have overproduction of all species, and as all species produce, you know, you have maybe start out with a couple of rabbits, and then you get four rabbits, and then you get 4 million rabbits, and so on. And if Yellowstone County can only support, let's say, 2 million rabbits, and you get 4 million rabbits, then you come to a struggle for survival. And the more fit rabbits are going to survive, and the less fit rabbits are not. And so you see this gradual change upward, because then after that struggle for survival, you have now a struggle of survival of the fittest among the fit, and then of the fittest among the fittest of the fit, and so on. And so things keep evolving upward. And there were some, Herbert Spencer, for example, in the late 1800s, who took Darwin's laws of natural selection and made them into a comprehensive worldview that would apply to psychology, to history, to economics. In fact, it's interesting, you take Darwin's theory of evolution, Karl Marx wanted to devote the English version of Das Kapital to Darwin, because he said, Darwin gave me a biological basis for the class struggle. Interestingly enough, Darwin refused the honor. You could say that Marx was a Darwinist, but Darwin was not a Marxist. And also, in the 1800s in America, you have some of those who believe in this tooth and claw survival of the fittest, laissez-faire capitalism, that also base their view on what they call social Darwinism. The idea that as a businessman, it is your duty to drive your competitor out of business and thereby produce a better product at a better price. And ultimately, the consumers are going to be regularly blessed with better products at better prices as evolution goes on in the marketplace. That's social Darwinism. And so we see many applications of it. We can even see, and I'm not going to talk about this tonight, how it becomes a basic view of biblical interpretation. This idea that the first five books of the Bible were not written by Moses, as they claim to be, and as our Lord Jesus Christ said they were, but rather were written by several different persons that we identify as J, E, D, and P over a period of hundreds of years, that's based on Darwinian concepts. And anyway, we could talk about the role of Darwinism in so many other areas, but it also applies in law. And particularly as we get into the 1870s, just a decade or so after Darwin, we start seeing a view of law, and it is promulgated especially at the Harvard Law School, particularly by a dean there by the name of Christopher Columbus Langdell, and then his successor, Roscoe Pound, and then by one of their best students, who later became a Justice of the United States Supreme Court, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., a view that we call legal positivism. And you see in the outline here, I've described what legal positivism is. It's the idea that, number one, there are no divine absolutes in law, or if there are, they're utterly irrelevant to our legal system today. And so if there are no divine absolutes, then what's the source of law? In this view, law is simply man-made. And when we say man-made, we mean made by that highest and most powerful human agency, the state. Law is law, not because God has ordained it so and because man is trying to understand and apply his law. Rather, law is law because the highest human authority, the state, has set it as law and has the muscle to back it up. Third principle of legal positivism is that law evolves. After all, if man evolves and man is the source of law, then law is going to evolve as man evolves. And so if you go to law school today, you will trace the evolution of a legal doctrine as it begins at one point and develops here and here and here, and this is what it ultimately becomes. And it is described as an evolutionary process. Well, who guides this process of the evolution of law? Pastors? Church councils? No, certainly not farmers or auto mechanics, but judges. And they do so as they write decisions. And when a judge makes a decision, he is taking part, in this view, in the evolution of law. A couple lawyers will go to court with a case that doesn't have a clear precedent behind it, and they'll get a precedent set by that court, and they'll come out and say, "We just made some law today." That sound you hear over there is Blackstone turning over in his grave, because he emphasized judges don't make law, they discover and apply the law that already exists. But if you don't believe there is any such natural body of law, then whenever a new principle is decided, we just made some new law. We just guided the evolution of law further. In fact, to give you an example of this, I'm going to cite Alexander Bickel. Bickel was a law professor at Yale, and Bickel once wrote, "The function of justices is to immerse themselves in the tradition of our society and of kindred societies that have gone before, in history and in the sediment of history which is law, and in the thought and the vision of the philosophers and the poets." That's what judges are supposed to do in this view. "The judges will then be fit to extract fundamental presuppositions from their deepest selves, but in fact from the evolving morality of our tradition." Now, why do we want judges to do this? Well, Bickel says, courts have certain capacities for dealing with matters of principle that legislators and executives do not have. I don't know if the tape can hear my eye roll at that, but I think it should be pretty obvious. Judges have, or should have, the leisure, the training, and the insulation to follow the ways of the scholar in pursuing the ends of government. Well, Judge Robert Bork, who held the position of the Alexander Bickel Professor of Law at one point, Judge Robert Bork once said, "Other than to heave a wistful sigh, I will pass by this vision of a judge's life without comment." No, judges don't have that kind of leisure, but that's the view that is given here. Judges, in their leisure, communing with their deep innermost selves, are evolving new principles of law. And so, if you want to study law by going to the original sources, where do you go? Not to the Constitution, not to the Federalist Papers. You go to the decisions of judges, because that, in this view, is the real source of law. In fact, if you'd gone to law school a couple hundred years ago, and you probably wouldn't have at that time, if you wanted to be a lawyer, you would just read extensively from the writings of Blackstone and other sources like this, and then you would apprentice yourself to a successful lawyer and watch him in court, take notes for him, and help him in drafting and filing his pleadings and so on. Then you'd take an oral exam and become a lawyer. But if you had gone to law school, you'd be reading some of these treatises like this. Today, when you go to law school, most of what you do is read the decisions of judges. We call it the case law method of legal study. Because if judges are the source of law, then to get at the sources of law, you need to read their decisions. Now, the Oak Brook College of Law, where I teach, and other schools that teach a biblical view of law, like Liberty University or Regent and a couple of others, at these, we will use this method because our students as graduate lawyers are going to need to know how judges think. But we will also give them the basic foundation in biblical law that in most law schools is missing. I remember some years ago, I attended a constitutional law conference in California, and there are about 30 constitutional law professors there. And one of the instructors there, one of the lecturers, just asked us, "How many of you, when you are teaching constitutional law, require your students to read the Constitution?" About a third of us raised our hands. The fact is, the average constitutional law textbook today will have a lot of discussion of cases dealing with the equal protection and due process clauses of the 14th Amendment. They will talk about the free speech and free exercise and establishment clauses of the First Amendment. They'll skip over the Second and Third and talk about search and seizure and self-incrimination and some of the other criminal procedure rights in the Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth and Eighth Amendments. They'll talk about the General Welfare Clause, the Interstate Commerce Clause in Article One. But probably 90-plus percent of the Constitution you would never even need to look at. And you could still get an A in constitutional law and pass the bar and practice law. Because we are using this case law method instead of looking to what law actually says. Now, something else. By the way, what time do we stop here tonight?
Around 9.
9, okay. I wasn't sure if it was 9 or a little bit later. Okay. Let's give a couple examples, then, of the way we've seen this evolutionary view of law and practice. One of these is in the area of capital punishment. Now, I'm not concerned here with whether you support or oppose capital punishment. I think there are good arguments on both sides, and one thing I've noticed is an increasing number of conservatives who have reservations about the death penalty, and that's fine. What I am concerned about is the misuse of the Constitution on this issue. There was a case back in 1972, Furman versus Georgia, in which the U.S. Supreme Court, by a 5-4 margin, held that capital punishment, as was being practiced in Georgia at that time under that statute, was unconstitutional. Now, they disagreed as to their reasons. A couple of them said that it violates equal protection because minorities were disproportionately affected. Others said that it violates due process because the defense wasn't given an adequate opportunity to present mitigating circumstances, couple other reasons given, but two of the justices, Justice Brennan and Justice Marshall, said that capital punishment is unconstitutional under any and all circumstances today because it violates the Eighth Amendment. Now, the Eighth Amendment prohibits cruel and unusual punishment, but it doesn't say capital punishment is cruel and unusual, and it seems very unlikely that that's what the framers of the Eighth Amendment meant. At the same time they adopted the Eighth Amendment, they also adopted the Fifth, which twice expressly refers to and sanctions capital punishment. The fact is, it was in use at that time. There were a few, like Ben Rush, who opposed it, but the overwhelming majority of Americans accepted it at that time. And so when they said that cruel and unusual punishment is prohibited, it certainly doesn't seem that they meant to prohibit capital punishment by this. And Brennan and Marshall, in their 1972 opinion, frankly acknowledge this. But as Brennan says in writing that opinion, the meaning of the amendment is not fixed and static. Rather, it must take its meaning from the evolving standard of decency that marks the progress of a maturing society. In other words, even though capital punishment might have been acceptable by the primitive and barbaric standards of 1789, it is not acceptable, it is cruel and unusual, by the humane and enlightened standards of today. An evolving standard of decency. Now, the problem with that evolving standard is that an evolving standard could move in more than one direction. An evolving standard could move toward a greater recognition of human rights and more humanity in the way we treat people. It could also move toward a new age of barbarism. And punishments like skinning alive and things like that that the founding fathers intended to prohibit like this, a judge might say that in today's tolerant and enlightened climate, in which we see violence around us and don't seem to be concerned about it, we don't think that capital punishment or that skinning alive or drawing and quartering is cruel and unusual by today's standards, and therefore we direct that the defendant be delivered to the taxidermist so the execution can proceed. And again, whether you favor or oppose capital punishment is not the issue. What concerns me is the use of this living or evolving standard as we seek to interpret the Constitution. Now, one of the first to talk about this was Woodrow Wilson. And if you want to read an interesting book sometime, after you get finished reading mine, of course, you might read his book from around 1915 or thereabouts, titled The New Freedom. It is a short book, but I hadn't really realized that Woodrow Wilson was as liberal in his thinking as he actually was, and how he laid the groundwork for so much liberal thought today. At one point, he talks about how there, when he had been president of Princeton, a professor came to speak at the university, and he said that professor told us that in every age, people tend to formulate all of their thinking around the dominant thought of the age. He said in the 1700s, the dominant thought was the Newtonian theory of the universe. Today, he says, and this is 100 years ago, but still today, the dominant thought, he said, is Darwinian evolution. He says, the makers of our Constitution read Montesquieu with true scientific enthusiasm. There were scientists in their way, the best way of their age, and they constructed a government as they would have constructed an orrery to display the laws of nature. Politics, in their thought, was a variety of mechanics. The Constitution was founded on the law of gravity. The government was to exist and move by virtue of the efficacy of checks and balances. The trouble with the theory is that government is not a machine, but a living thing. It falls not under the theory of the universe, but under the theory of organic life. Now listen to this sentence. It is accountable to Darwin, not to Newton. He goes on to say, living political constitutions must be Darwinian in structure and practice. Society is a living organism and must obey the laws of life, not of mechanics. It must develop. All that progressives ask or desire is permission, in an era when development, evolution is the scientific word, to interpret the Constitution according to the Darwinian principle. That's where the living Constitution idea comes from, the idea that we're giving the Constitution a Darwinian interpretation. Let me give you another example. This is a case from 1937, National Labor Relations Board versus Jones and Laughlin Steel. Now, the Constitution says that the Congress has power to regulate commerce, and to regulate three types of commerce. I always tell my law students, you can remember this by the three I's: interstate commerce, international commerce, and Indian commerce, commerce with the Indian nations. But what is restricted here, and remember, when the Constitution delegates power, anything not delegated is reserved to the states or to the people. What the federal government does not have power to regulate then is commerce within a state or local production. And that's the way it was understood for nearly 150 years. But then this case comes along in which there is a labor dispute at the Jones and Laughlin Steel Company, and the National Labor Relations Board, which was newly created at that time, wants to intervene. And Jones and Laughlin says, bug off, you have no jurisdiction here. And they say, oh yes we do, because we have power to regulate interstate commerce. And Jones and Laughlin says, double bug off, this is not interstate, this is within a state, and it is not commerce, it is local production. Case went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and by a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court said this. They said that if there are unresolved labor disputes within the steel industry, those disputes could lead to strikes. Strikes in the steel industry could lead to a shutdown or showdown of steel production. A shutdown of steel production could disrupt the flow of steel in interstate commerce. So, if in order to regulate the free flow of steel interstate commerce, it is necessary for Congress to set up an agency to intervene in local labor disputes, Congress has that power. 5-4 decision, 1937. 4 years later, we see where this evolves to still greater power, the case of Wickard versus Filburn. And Farmer Filburn in Ohio was raising corn, and raising corn in excess of his allotted acres. The government at this time, we had a surplus of production, they said, and that was causing the price of corn to be depressed. And so if we can cut down production, then the supply will go down. If the demand remains the same, then the price will go up, and that will get farmers out of their depression. After all, today all they need is Prozac. Then they needed something else to get out of depression. And so Farmer Filburn was restricted to a certain number of acres. He grew corn on an excess number of acres beyond what he was allotted. But he said, I have a right to do that because I'm taking all of that excess grain and I am feeding it to my own hogs on my own farm. And he's prosecuted for this. And he asks, or his lawyers ask in court, how in the world can you say that the corn that I grow on my own farm and feed to my own pigs is interstate commerce? Well, the court's answer is, that's simple, we can do it. You see, if you hadn't raised that excess corn, then you would have had to feed your hogs from feed within your excess acres. You would have had less grain to sell in the market, and so that would have affected interstate commerce. Or if you hadn't done that, then you would have had to buy feed on the market, and that would have affected interstate commerce. So either way, Farmer Filburn, you have potentially affected interstate commerce, and that's all that is necessary in order to regulate you. Well, you can see where Congress has gone from a stretch of the imagination to outright fantasy land. And I'd have to say that I think as we look to interpretations like this, we are going not just from a Darwinian view of truth, we are going over to a New Age view of truth, which is that you can create your own truth, that truth is subjective, it is whatever you want it to be. And we look to the postmodern, as we call it today, which is really kind of an academic extension of what we used to call the New Age a few decades ago, and the postmodern idea being that logic and such, these are all merely social constructs, and we need to get beyond these things and get to subjective thought. And then we go within that to what we even call language deconstruction. Now, none of this makes any sense unless you've had, I don't know how many years of university education to get your mind addled to the point that you can start to think of some of these things. People that have to work for a living don't think about this kind of stuff. But the idea of language deconstruction simply says that words have no fixed meanings, and the true meaning of a word is not what the dictionary says it is, or what the originators of that word said, or what those who use it intended by it. It is what those who might be reading it or hearing it today understand by it. That's what a word really means. Now, this has a lot of practical implications. Not practical, but implications anyway. Like, for example, if you're in drama, and if in drama you are going to present a play of Romeo and Juliet, if you are a classical dramatist, you'll want to produce it as close to what Shakespeare intended it to be as you possibly can. If you're in the postmodern, you might just try to make it into a version of West Side Story or something like that instead. And if you do, I don't know, there's not that much harm to be done. But if you have a judge who holds this postmodern view and thinks that he's not bound by either the objective evidence or by the plain meaning of words when he makes his ruling, you can see where the potential for destruction is just unlimited. We go from there to a case like, for example, Roe versus Wade, the abortion decision of 1973, where the Supreme Court, by a vote of 7-2, with Justice Rehnquist and White writing some very fine dissenting opinions, but the court in that time saying that there is a constitutional right to abortion, and therefore the laws of Texas and of nearly all other states at that time that restricted abortion were unconstitutional. Well, it's fair to ask Justice Blackmun, the author of that opinion, where do you find in the Constitution this right to an abortion? And here is the answer he gives. And it's based on an opinion about a decade earlier by Justice Brennan in the Griswold case dealing with birth control. But he says that certain rights in the Bill of Rights have penumbras and emanations. Now, penumbra is a word most of us wouldn't bother to look up. It means a shadow or an aura. And he says that when we see that word liberty in the 14th Amendment, there are certain emanations that flow out of it. And among these are the right to make decisions concerning your life, including the decision whether to marry, the decision whether to have children, and that decision should be a retroactive decision that you could make with a child that is already in the womb. And so he seems to be saying that he's been issued a special set of glasses, and so when he reads the Constitution, he sees emanations flowing out of the Bill of Rights, and these coalesce into penumbras between the paragraphs or in the margins, and there he sees things like abortion and later homosexual rights and same-sex marriage and other such things written. Again, this isn't even Darwinian, this is postmodern language deconstruction. And we go from there to the Obergefell decision a couple of years ago, the 5-4 decision of the Supreme Court, in which the court holds that the Constitution guarantees a right to same-sex marriage. Justice Kennedy, writing that majority opinion, openly says that The framers of the 14th Amendment, when they spoke of liberty, did not define its outer limits. Rather, they left that for future generations, meaning us five majority justices on the Supreme Court. Now, Justices Alito and Thomas and Scalia and Roberts all wrote some very fine dissenting opinions in that case. Justice Roberts says, "I know some will celebrate this decision, but no one should celebrate it as a victory for the Constitution, because it has nothing to do with the Constitution itself." Justice Scalia wrote what I thought was the most scathing and in many ways the best dissent when he quotes Kennedy's words there about future generations and says, by those future generations, he's really talking about us, the unelected justices of the Supreme Court. And he says, we are not representative of the American people. We're not appointed. We're not elected. We are appointed. And we're not even representative of the legal community. He says, out of us nine justices in the court, every one of us is a graduate of either Harvard or Yale. Most of us come out of the Northeast, one from the Great Lakes. He says, none come from the Midwest. None come from the mountain states. That's changed now with Gorsuch. None come from the South. None come from the West. And then he puts in parentheses after that, California does not count. Yeah. But he says the framers railed against taxation without representation. We have something worse. Social transformation without representation. And that is what the court is doing with this living constitution. The danger of the living constitution, number one, no rights are secure under this constitution. If a court can read into the constitution rights that are not there, as it is regularly doing now, it can also read out of the constitution rights that are there. Rights like the right to make and enforce contracts, the right to own and use property, the right to free exercise of religion, the right to keep and bear arms. And all of these rights, except for the latter, have been greatly watered down by the court today. The latter, the right to keep and bear arms, has been upheld, but only by a 5-4 vote. There were four of those justices who said this is not even an individual right. There is no individual right to bear arms. That's what jeopardy we have with this right to bear arms. Even that is in jeopardy with this living constitution approach. It gives judges virtually unchecked power. Remember those words out of Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass, where Alice and Humpty Dumpty are having a conversation, and Humpty Dumpty says, "Now there's a knockdown, drag-out argument for you." And Alice says, "What do you mean by knockdown, drag-out argument?" And Humpty Dumpty says, "When I use a word, it means exactly what I want it to mean, nothing more and nothing less." And Alice says, "The question is, can you make words mean different things?" And Humpty Dumpty answers, "The question is, who is to be master? That is all." And he is right. If judges are free to make the words of the Constitution mean whatever they want them to mean, then judges have become our masters. And this is not the frame of government that our framers thought they were creating. I don't think it's the kind of government that we want today. Also, under this living constitution approach, there is no basis for saying there is any such thing as an unjust decision. That's one of the reasons why I think most lawyers today really believe in a higher law. I have said that anytime a lawyer walks out of the Supreme Court, having lost his case there, and says, "I got a raw deal," he is saying there is a higher law. Because if there isn't, then how can he say he got a raw deal? If the Supreme Court is the highest law, then whatever they say has to be just. No, this living constitution approach is a dangerous approach to liberty. And what we need is not a living constitution. What we need is an enduring constitution that will protect our rights in 1787, our rights today and our rights for all time.
Amen.
That's the Constitution the framers thought they gave us, and that's the Constitution we need to preserve. I'll turn it back over to Dick Vince.
Stay here. Thank you this time, huh?
Yeah.
You're